I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. So, last fall, just 10 days after October 7th, Bassem Youssef went on Piers Morgan's YouTube show and briefly broke the internet with what his interviewer referred to as dark humor about the early days of Israel's military assault on Gaza.
It's just like those Palestinians, they're very dramatic. Israel killing us. But they never die. I mean, they always come back. You know, they're very difficult to kill, very difficult people to kill. I know because I'm married to one. Mm. I tried many times, couldn't kill her.
I mean, there's a dark humor there, and I understand why. Because
It's not dark humor. I try to get to her every time, but she uses our kids as human shields. I can never take her out.
Almost 5 months later, that interview has been viewed by more than 22 million people. Clearly, it struck a nerve. And as the heart surgeon turned comedian, commonly known as the Egyptian John Stewart, tells me in this week's episode, it has also transformed his career, for better and worse. Bassem has a truly fascinating life story, which was chronicled in the 2017 documentary Tickling Giants, in which he is currently telling on stage as part of his global Middle Beast tour. But for this conversation, I really wanted to focus on his incredibly strong opinions about both the war and President Joe Biden's complicity in it, a sentiment that is being loudly echoed in both polls and at the primary ballot box in recent weeks. We don't necessarily agree on all of it, but I think it's an important conversation to have, especially with someone who has proven so adept at using comedy and satire to bring attention to those points. We began our conversation by talking about his friend Jon Stewart's big return to The Daily Show. So before we get into it, here's a clip of Bassem sharing part of his story at Stewart's Mark Twain Prize ceremony in 2022.
Cairo, Egypt, 2003. Yes. That was the first time I ever saw Jon Stewart on something called a television. We didn't have Comedy Central there, and YouTube was not even invented. But every Arab home had CNN. You see, after the first Iraq war, CNN functioned as an early warning system to know where America would strike us next. And it was CNN when I first saw Jon Stewart. It was the once a week global edition of The Daily Show. And honestly, I didn't really understand his jokes. And for someone like me living in the Middle East, I didn't understand who are Democrats. What is a Republican? And why is he so pissed at Fox News? But because of John, I became aware of political satire and American messed up politics. I had a dream to have a similar show in Egypt. But at that time, it was almost impossible. We had a president for 30 years. And in the Middle East, that is a very short first term. But Cairo, Egypt, 2011, the Arab Spring happened, and we had an opportunity. I made a couple of YouTube videos channeling a very cheap knockoff version of The Daily Show, and it went viral. And before I knew it, I was on television with a very small show. On that day, I left medicine, and because of that decision, many more patients are alive today.
Bassem, it's so great to have you here. I was remembering we got to meet up for an interview back around the release of Tickling Giants, the documentary about you, all the way back in the summer of 2017, I believe. So I feel like a lot has happened in the world since then. A lot has happened in your life since then. So I'm glad that we could reconnect now.
Yes, thank you so much.
Where are you?
I'm in Los Angeles.
You're in LA still? Yeah. I was wondering if you were on the road or what's going on. But yeah, I thought maybe we could start by talking about, it's a question that I think I asked you the last time we met, but it's the nickname that I think still follows you everywhere you go, which is the Egyptian John Stewart. I remember then you still felt pretty good about it. I was curious how you feel about it now that people still think of you that way.
Well, I mean, like, it's an honor. I mean, John Stewart has been, someone has been my idol, so to be linked to his name in any ways is an honor, not something to be shy away from.
Yeah, definitely. Have you been watching his big return to The Daily Show that kind of came out of nowhere?
Yeah. I'm very happy that he's back. Of course, I hope that he would have been there more than one, but, you know, we'll take the once in a week return.
Take what we can get.
Yes.
Yeah, what have you thought of his pieces so far? I think he got some backlash from the left in that first week for criticizing Biden, and I was curious what you made of that.
I mean, like, my point of view about Biden is known, and the fact that, like, right, America all it has to offer is like two geriatric men to run for presidency is just like a shame. And and his Tucker Carlson piece was wonderful.
Yeah, I think one moment that got less attention from that first episode, he was mostly going after Biden for the age stuff, but he also did call out the president for sort of understating Israel's response as over the top. And then he went a little bit further this past week talking about it. But obviously he's not gone as hard against Biden as you have in different venues.
Yeah, and also his piece about Israel, it was kind of like it was funny, but it's also like very centric, and I understand where it comes from, but, like, you know, the idea of, like, he talks about blaming the UN, and everybody knows the UN is useless, but, like, the UN is not the problem. The Arab nation is not the problem. The problem is the Israel that keeps on building illegal settlements, keep defying international law, keep having, like, unlimited support from America, and the kind of, like, to kind of diffuse the blame to just bring in why the UN is useless, or the UN is useless and the Security Council is useless because it's been controlled by the United States. And the fact that, like, you can do whatever resolution you want and then America kind of does the veto, it makes it rendered, like, useless. So, yeah, it was kind of like a way to kind of, like, sit in the middle and kind of blame everybody, which is, like, a legitimate comedic style. But as someone who's from that part of the world, I cannot kind of, like, just, like, stay in the middle, and I can see who's the perpetrator and who's to really blame, and who has the power, who's the people who are in the position of power, they are the people who should be blamed more.
Would you please be more careful with your bombing? It's good advice. But really, couldn't the United States have told Israel that when we gave them all the bombs? There are bombs. This is like your Coke dealer coming in with an 8-ball and going, don't stay up all night. Don't. Sleep is very important. You got to sleep. You don't want to. And breakfast is an important part of the day. So, look, the Israeli position doesn't seem so tenable. Perhaps I can find some diplomatic leeway in the Hamas position.
Israel is a country that has no place on our land. We must remove that country.
Does that mean the annihilation of Israel?
Yes, of course.
I cannot find diplomatic leeway in the Hamas position.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, John Stewart gets a lot of flack, I guess, got a lot of flack for doing sort of both sides-ism on Trump versus Biden, but maybe you're saying he's doing a little bit of that on the Israel-Gaza issue as well.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, that's his opinion as a comedian, and that's the thing, the beauty about, like, freedom of expression, that he can say, I might not, like, agree with everything that he said, but I appreciate his voice and appreciate him being back, even if I don't agree with everything that he say or how he managed to put it up there. But that's the problem. Why do you have comedians having to say to face backlash just because he didn't say exactly what you want? I mean, again, like, I don't agree with his take on the Palestine Israel take, but he is a comedian at the end of the day, and his voice, and that's his way of expression. And I shouldn't be directed my anger to him. I should direct my anger to the people who are serious positions of power who are letting this go.
Yeah, I think he was sort of elevated to this place of being a, whether it's an activist or just a voice for the left in a way that it seems like maybe he hasn't been entirely comfortable with, you know, and trying to maybe push back a little bit on that as well.
Yeah.
You had a quote recently in an interview where you said, I don't want Trump to win, but I want Joe Biden to lose. And I thought that that really summed up the way I think a lot of people feel right now in the Arab American community, but in all types of people. How do you think about that? Because you have to recognize that that is the reality. One of those two men, unless something really crazy happens, is going to be the president. So how do you reconcile that?
I mean, I don't have to pay for the fact that like America has bad options, you know, like if somebody is giving you two horrible cars, I don't have to buy them. Seriously, I would rather walk or take the bus. But the whole idea that like as if I have to be blackmailed or cornered to having to choose one. One of them is like obviously racist, right-wing white supremacist, and the other one has been openly saying that I'm a Zionist, and that like, and it's just like whole idea about demeaning the United States. I hear people like Nikki Haley and other people saying like Israel doesn't need America, but America needs Israel. Really? Have we been that belittling ourselves as a nation? We are the super. I'm talking now as an American citizen.
Yeah.
We are the superpower of the world. We are the basically the empire of the world, and we are the one who needs Israel. Like how? It's a client state. We pay for their lunch, and what do we get in return? And what we get in return is terrible. What we get in return is like our image and our position in the world being compromised because of we are supporting a rogue, unfair state. And the fact that that he comes in a couple of days, like he went on Seth Meyers and he said, like, I'm a proud Zionist. And the fact that he says that Jewish people do not feel safe anywhere and that's why they have Israel, that is the worst thing that you can say for Jewish people. Basically, you're telling every Jewish person that you're not safe in your country, you're not safe in America, and your loyalty has to be towards Israel. So as an American Jewish person, now I have to choose between my loyalty to Israel and my loyalty to my home, my home country, America. That is terrible. That is a terrible thing to say. That is not even good for the Jewish people. And they don't feel included. It's like saying like you as a Muslim don't feel anywhere safe and you need to go back to your country. That's a terrible thing to say.
Do you think there is something that he could be doing, should be doing on this issue that would win back your vote, you know, and could win back the votes of all these people who have said, you know, like all the people who voted uncommitted in Michigan, you know, that could get them or you specifically, you know, back on his side. What do you think he should be doing?
I don't know. I think it's too late now. I think if he did anything now, it's been too late after all of these people killed. And if he did it now, he'll do it purely for election reasons, which means that after the election, he's just going to go back to letting Israel does what he does. So I don't know.
You think it's too late? It's the ship has sailed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but that's my opinion. My opinion doesn't matter. I'm just like one person and I live in California, which where my vote doesn't count anyway. So,
I mean, you became a U.S. citizen, I think, you know, about 5 years ago or so. How do you feel about that decision now? Because, you know, I think you've said that it's a shame that it only took this long for you to kind of be so disillusioned by, you know, American politics and democracy. So,
yeah, it is very sad. I'm very happy to be an American citizen, by the way, and I'm very happy to be part of this country. I think that this is a great country. It has a lot to offer, and it gave me a second chance and a second like chance on life, and I appreciate that, of course. But I'm, you know, like many Americans, we love the country, we don't like the policies. I'm Egyptian, I love Egypt, but I didn't like the policies. I didn't like the leadership. And it is just very disheartening to have this illusion of freedom of expression while you cannot really change anything and you find your politician follow the people who pay for their campaign money and then follow their votes, which is turning the United States from a democracy to an oligarchy. Basically, it's the special interest groups that control the politicians because of the money that they pay for their campaigns, not the votes.
Yeah, I mean, when we talked last time, it was that first year of Trump's first term, and you were sort of expressing concerns about the U.S. becoming more like Egypt under Trump, and something that seems like it would only exacerbate, you know, in a second Trump term where he had even less restrictions. So do you still worry about that?
Well, I'm worrying about a Trump presidency. I'm really worried that this will be some sort of a vengeance tour when he comes back.
Yeah, I mean, he's said as much, right?
Yeah, and I'm worried about that, of course. And I really hope that doesn't happen. But I really don't know what can be done with that. And I'm worried. Yeah, I have all kinds of things to worry. But in the same time, I don't know how can I go and give Trump Biden my voice.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really it's a tricky situation that I think, you know, I fall more on the side of, you know, that Trump is so much more of an existential threat to so many groups and beyond this one issue, whether it's, you know, with women and climate change and all of these other things. But, you know, I know it's obviously this is a very personal issue for you.
Yeah. And again, it's not just like a personal issue. It's like it's a human issue more than anything, you know, and it's that is why it's disheartening to talk about things that should be common sense, like stop killing, bombing civilians. But you were being gaslighting, saying, oh, we're just doing it for Hamas and for stuff. It's just like very disheartening.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised in some ways that you say that there's nothing that could be done now to change that. And I think, because I think that, you know, I mentioned the Michigan thing, and I think that was the goal of that uncommitted campaign, I think, was to push Biden to change, right?
Well, I hope it works.
Coming up, Bossom breaks down why he decided to talk to Piers Morgan in the first place, and how he carefully crafted the very dark jokes in a way designed to make the appearance go viral.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our episodes with other Daily Show alums like Lewis Black, Samantha Bee, Jordan Klepper, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Bossom Youssef. Well, I want to talk about sort of this moment in your career. You know, you're obviously getting a lot of sort of renewed attention that I think started with that interview with Piers Morgan, which was watched by millions and millions of people. I didn't even quite realize looking back that it was only 10 days after October 7th. So I think it was in a very charged moment, you know, all over the world, but in this country as well. How did that even come about that you decided to go on that show? I mean, you couldn't have known the impact that it would have when you chose to do that.
Well, as I said before, I was offered to be on the show a couple of times, and I said no because I was scared to go out and speak about this. It's a very charged issue, but like by the third time they asked me, I was already like watching, you know, some of the interviews on Piers Morgan, and my blood was boiling because the Israeli narrative was going there unopposed, and it was very disheartening to see that there's no one is speaking up on the other side. So it was I felt that like I had to do something about it.
What was your goal going into it? What did you want to convey?
I wanted to make a kind of a different impact where I had to kind of like make a difference so people would pay attention to what's going on, whether that was to, like using dark satire or like very, you know, a subversive humor, but I had to make something that is different from whatever people are saying on television. I didn't know if that would even work. So I went in, took the risk, and it worked for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of trying to figure out why it, you know, had as big of an impact as it did, why it resonated so much. And I think that as you said, the dark satire, I think, is a huge part of that. I mean, we've been having a pretty serious conversation, but this is a podcast about comedy. And I think the way that you used comedy in that interview was fascinating to me. And I think kind of confounding to Piers Morgan, he didn't really know what to make of it. And he kind of kept commenting on the comedy, and you pushed back saying, you know, this is claiming that you weren't being trying to be funny. I'm not sure you were trying to be funny, but it seems like you were trying to use satire to make a point. So how did you think about that? Was that something you sort of knew you wanted to do, or was it sort of something that happened in the moment?
No, this is something that I actually planned. Like, I planned my talking points, I planned my jokes, I planned my punchlines, and I have no problem like admitting that, because I had to go in prepared. I just couldn't go there and just like wing it. This is what I do every time I go on something like that, because English is my second language, and I cannot afford to not perform well, especially into something that is very high stakes like that. So I did prepare my entrance and my jokes and my thing. I'm a planner. I'm a nerd. What do I?
Yeah, I mean, you prepared for it almost the way you would prepare for a stand up or a comedy show.
Yeah, I did.
And what was the process of that? Sort of just imagining what you might be asked and thinking about how you would respond.
I imagine different scenarios, and I imagine my responses, and I imagine actually a way that to kind of even push the interviewer to get me into that space where I can say it. So I would either some of my points were made to be a reactive way, reacting to whatever they say, and some of them were planned in order to push them to ask me that.
Yeah, is there an example of that you could think of, something you sort of...
So for example, when I told him this whole thing about making him compare Israel to ISIS, I planned that. I told him I want to understand the concept. I want to understand what Israel is doing. Do you think that they're bombing them so they would push the civilians to reject Hamas and kind of like change their affiliation? He said, yes. I was like, well, that's what terrorist groups does, because they know that they cannot beat a nation. So they terrorize people in order to change and to flip them against their own current regimes. Because ISIS and Qaeda knew that they will not defeat America, but they would cause enough terror to make people turn against their own people, against their own government.
There's a very important point here. You know, I want to understand what is the logic of Israel carpet bombing Gaza. I mean, if there is a logic, if this will make Israel safe, I want to hear the logic. So if they continue bombing, what are they hoping to achieve?
We know what their stated aim is. Their stated aim is to eradicate and wipe out Hamas. They believe Hamas are living predominantly in northern Gaza. They also are aware they're living amongst civilians. So it's an incredibly difficult thing. It is very, very difficult to see how they do this without massive collateral damage.
So if I can understand this correctly, basically Israel is doing this to pressure the Palestinian community in Gaza to turn against Hamas. Is that right?
I'm sure that's part of it, yes.
That's part of it. So this is exactly what terrorist organizations do, because terrorist organizations will have no chance beating a whole nation in battle. So they terrorize and they kill the civilians in order to spread fear and terror so they can turn against their government to change their policy or to resign. You have just compared Israel with ISIS.
No, I haven't. I don't see any comparison between Israel.
It's going to be
ISIS.
The headlines tomorrow. Israel is ISIS.
Only amongst people who weren't listening.
What kind of feedback were you getting sort of immediately after you did that? Was it a lot of support at first, or people attacking you, or both? Or how did you kind of experience the impact?
There was a lot of support and celebration after the first interview, because it was so big and so huge. The second interview I had, it was a mixed feeling, especially from my side, because there are a lot of people who don't like me on the Arab and the Islamic side for obvious reasons. So they only took the part when I said, yes, Hamas is a terrorist group, because I didn't want to be dragged into that kind of conversation. It's like an endless conversation that you cannot win. And I didn't want to actually go and discuss if Hamas is terrorist or not, because that's really beyond the point. So people just like took that part. And I told the people who attended my interview, I told them, there will be a wave of attack in the beginning, which did happen for a week or for 2-3 days until people watched the full interview. Because I know the people that hated me would just cut this part and put it, and that was the narrative that was being put up there. And then people started watching the rest of the interview, and kind of like I had the support coming back again.
Yeah, you did the first one over satellite or whatever, where you had the earpiece popping out of your ear and some technical difficulties. But then you decided to go sit down with Piers Morgan, face to face for I think almost 2 hours. How was it different to engage with him on that sort of more intimate level?
From the get-go, I wanted to have that one-to-one interview. So that part of the reason why I wanted the first interview to be go viral is to him and his team to kind of like agree for a one-to-one. Because at the end of the day, the comedy and the satire at the beginning is good, but it doesn't really go to the core of the issue. And I wanted to discuss the core of the issue. And that doesn't happen over satellite, and that doesn't happen just through satire. It has to be like a good sit-down explanation, which I tried to do.
As we said, this interview, I think, has had a big impact on your career. It's brought you, probably the most attention you've received since, the Arab Spring and everything that you were doing, in Egypt. Has it been a mix of positive and negative? Do you think it's been, what are the sort of good things and bad things that have come out of it?
Mostly it was positive, and I'm very grateful for that. There's a lot of support and a lot of admiration. Of course, there's always negative. There's always people that will have a backlash. There's people, for example, that would call me anti-Semitic. There are people talk to me like a Jewish hater. I'll always have that. It was like, he doesn't have a problem with Israel. He has a problem with Jewish people, which is a way to shut down the conversation. Of course, it's ridiculous. And I had this before, this kind of like blanket accusation that puts you in a way that like discredits you. I was called all kinds of things. It's funny now that the pro-Zionist people are calling me a Muslim Brotherhood, which is crazy because from the base of my history, that's
Don't know much about your history.
Yeah, and of course the Islamists never like me. Whatever they say, they have this grudge against me because they thought that I'm their mortal enemy because I was against the Muslim Brotherhood, and the pro-military people don't like me because I'm against the army. So I've always been like someone in the middle who's been not liked by everybody because I don't fit their narrative 100%. And there is a way to vilify people who are against you. So I'm used to that. But I'm very grateful that it was mostly positive on all fronts almost. But now and I just want to focus on the positive instead of just like reminiscing about the negative.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about your tour and sort of what you're doing on stage and how it's maybe different from this. But I am curious. We talk a lot on this podcast and in the sort of comedy world about comedians who complain that they aren't allowed to say anything or that they're going to be canceled or they're going to have consequences. You're someone who knows what actual government censorship and getting arrested for speaking out against the government is. So how do you think about the American comedians who complain that they aren't allowed to say anything, that they're going to face these kind of career consequences for speaking their mind?
Well, I think you should complain, and I don't think we should belittle their concerns. At the end of the day, you cannot tell them you be thankful because back home, back in Egypt or the Middle East, you're not going to be allowed to say anything. I think freedom of expression is not a luxury. It is something that we should strive for, and we should strive for the best service. If we claim that we are a country of free expression, we should actually claim it to be at the highest level of service and the highest level of freedom of expression, instead of saying you should be grateful. Because I know what it means to be canceled. I know what it means to be shut down. You guys have been canceled on Twitter. I've been canceled in real life. I think we should actually strive for the best level of freedom of expression, no matter how privileged we are.
It is the same, comedians who complain about it are, incredibly successful, are not necessarily losing opportunities, but they are facing criticism for what they say. So there's a difference between...
But that's their job. too. That's your job too. If you're successful, you need to protect your livelihood and you need to protect the art form that you love and that you work on. Because if the people who are successful and big don't speak about that, because when someone is successful and big speak about that, he has a big platform and he can actually make a bigger effect. So yes, I think they should actually speak about it, no matter how successful or how unaffected they are with the PC culture or the cancellation.
So you're heading out on your what I believe is going to be a global tour, the Middle Beast tour. You've been doing some shows in the States, but then you're going to be doing some elsewhere as well.
Yes, I am doing Detroit coming up. I am doing a big European tour in April. I'm doing about like 10, 12 cities. It's doing, so that's that. I'm excited about that. I'm also doing stuff in the Middle East, in Abu Dhabi and Kuwait.
I was curious how your show changes or how the response from the audience changes based on where you are in the world, whether you're performing in, you know, the States or in Europe or in the Middle East. Do you feel that it is very different, or do you kind of have the same experience place to place?
It's of course it's different, because there's certain things that are very specific for United States. I designed this as an immigrant coming to the United States. So maybe in Europe and in the Middle East, I have to find a little bit of ways to explain more, or to kind of give more kind of background explanation for what's going on. So I find it very interesting that still in people in Europe and in the Middle East will actually kind of relate to my jokes and relate to my show, which is very interesting.
What can people expect from, you know, your comedy, you know, maybe who are, have only seen you, you know, in these sort of viral moments and interviews? Because I know it is quite different, right?
Yes, well, my show is the same. It's a personal story. That's why anybody from the Middle East or Europe or America can relate to it. It's not really American-centric. It has early elements, of course, of like being in America. But at the end of the day, it's my own personal story, from Egypt to being a doctor, to being a political satirist, to being here in a stand-up comedian, to being here in America, as Trump becoming president. All of that has actually works into the show. So I don't really bring what the current events of what's happening in the Middle East in the show, because I don't want to make it part of it until I'm ready. So I don't think it's the right time now. I'm focused on doing my own 1 hour show.
Do you imagine that would be a big part of a, you know, future hour of material or something that you would want to talk about on stage?
I think it might be.
Yeah. Is that something that you're already kind of thinking about, or how you would go about talking about it?
Yeah, I'm kind of like, I don't want to kind of like have a lot of anxiety of trying to plan what's going on, Lena, because I've already been dealing with a lot of anxiety trying to get my hour, like, you know, more tight. So I try not to be too overwhelmed with the outcome of the future ventures. I want to focus on what's going on right now.
You know, your story is so fascinating. And I think for anyone, especially who's interested, should definitely check out that documentary I mentioned at the top, Tickling Giants, that was made by someone who worked at The Daily Show. You know, how do you think about it? It chronicles your decision to, you know, give up being a heart surgeon in Egypt for this life in comedy. Now that it's been, you know, a decade or more, how do you feel about that decision? Do you feel like, you know, do you have any regrets about how you handled anything, or do you feel good about deciding to do that?
I'm very grateful about how my life evolved so far within comedy and medicine. And I'm very grateful that I had that kind of chance to express myself. And I wouldn't take anything back. I wouldn't change anything, even the mistakes, even the bad things that happened. I learned from it. And it's because of them that I am where I am right now. So there's kind of like a overall sense of gratitude and acceptance and appreciation of where I am. And I'm just like happy to be given that chance. I think it's very unique, and not anybody get to live that kind of life.
Yeah, I mean, it's like living two lives. I mean, most comedians have been, you know, wanted to be comedians since they were, you know, kids, and then get started even in their teens. But you obviously had a much later start in this than a lot of people, but it's worked out in a really impressive way.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm grateful for that kind of dual, triple, quadruple life that I have.
So I want to do our segment now called The First Laugh. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions and just to see what comes to mind, starting with the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid growing up, when you think about that, you know, what was the comedy that you were drawn to very early on?
Tom and Jerry.
Yeah. Cartoons and slapstick.
Absolutely, yeah. Tom and Jerry for a kid. That's like you see that, and then I started to mature watching the Muppet Show. The Muppet Show is something that you appreciate the more you grow up and the more you get older, because it's a very smart comedy. It is a Muppet Show, but it is not for kids. I mean, it is for kids, but there is very interesting adult humor there that you appreciated as you grew up. So maybe the Muppet Show was my first.
You know, we said you got a late start in comedy in a lot of ways, but do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny, that you had the ability to make other people laugh?
I used to, when I was in medicine, I would collect people around me and tell them jokes. I had a good memory, so I would have a repertoire of like tens of jokes and I would remember all of them. And
you were the funny doctor?
Not really. There were people who were funnier than me. But I was funny. I was funny in some circles, and some circles I was not. I think that's the thing about like how comedy is very subjective.
What were do you remember any of the jokes that you used to make the other doctors laugh?
And so if I do, it's going to be in Arabic and it's going to be like very difficult to,
to translate.
Yeah.
You know, once you decided to make this pivot into comedy, what was the actual first time that you tried doing stand-up comedy, that you got up and tried telling jokes in that way? Where were you? How did it go? What do you remember about it?
I hosted a couple of stand-up comedy shows in Egypt when I was hosting the show. And it was interesting because I was hosting those like big names while but my name on the poster was bigger than all of them because I was the local star. But then I found myself bigger than the other names. Like, guys, that doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, people coming for you, but they don't care. And I did like something that I wasn't very happy with, but like people liked it. But I said like, stand-up comedy is not for me. And then when I came here to the United States, I had to pivot and teach myself stand-up comedy. And it wasn't very easy at the beginning. And it had a very rough start. And I even started as like giving speeches in the speaker circles in universities and other places. And then I started to develop that speech into a one-man show, and then from that one-man show to a stand-up comedy. So it didn't just like happen overnight. It just happened over the years.
Yeah. I mean, and doing it in your second language in the States, you know, is another challenge. What was that like for you to kind of figure out how to be funny in English? Did that take an extra level of work?
Oh, no, it's a work in progress. And it's something that I have to deal with every single day. And I have to find the right tone, the right timing, and the right delivery. And it's never ending because you discover something about yourself and you discover something about the language. And it just like it keeps evolving.
Do you remember the first joke that did really work in English that you were able to tell on stage or bit or something that you really connected with an audience and you were happy with?
It was not like something on stage that I said. It was something that I said when I was covering the Republican National Convention, and I was asked about like, what do you think of Fox News? And I said, like, I think like people think that Arab and Muslims hate Fox News. It's not true. We love Fox News because it's the only place on the planet where white, blonde, beautiful women talk about us the whole time. We don't get that kind of attention anywhere else. They're obsessed with us. So that's one of the first ones. Yeah.
I know, you know, at a certain point you were able to start appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart some. What was that first time that you appeared on the show? What do you remember about it and sort of the experience of getting to do that for the first time?
Well, I was with my team to shadow the Daily Show team to understand how to make us like live comedy shows, because we didn't have that kind of craft in Egypt. How can they put the pictures like next to them? How all of this was something that we didn't know how to do. So we kind of shadowed. We wanted to know what's the writing process. And when I was there, I was invited by John to sit with him for 15 minutes, and that 15 minutes went to an hour and a half. And from that, he invited me to be on the show. So again, it was kind of a roller coaster of emotions to be there.
And then you actually got to do some comedy bits on the show as well. How was that, you know, different? And what was it like sort of doing comedy with John?
Yeah, I was, of course, like to be a correspondent. I was a correspondent for 4 years, so I was very happy to be there. It's like I look at my time with The Daily Show with like a lot of gratitude and a lot of warmth and love, because, you know, to have someone as your idol and have him to put him in such a high place, and then he brings you in to be on his show. and he even invites me to give tribute to him in the Mark Twain Prize. That is something that meant a lot to me.
Boston, thanks for joining us. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Obviously, right now the Middle East spiraling out of control. So tell me, what should America do about this?
Well, how about nothing? Yes. I feel the love. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We haven't tried that one yet.
Yeah. We noticed. How do you think our region got this way in the first place? For decades, America propped up a who's who of military and theocratic dictators. They gave you what you wanted. Oil. Airfields. Oil. Security arrangements. Oil. And let's not forget a few torture black sites.
Hey, hey. Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me?
We know what you're into. Mr. Gray will see you now. And in return, the dictators got someone their people could hate instead of them. When the garbage back home doesn't get picked up for a week, who do you think people blame?
I'm going to go with the... That's an easy one. I'm going to go with the sanitation department.
Exactly. We blame America.
Has there been any talk about you going back on as a correspondent now that John is back and maybe talking about the Israel-Palestine issue at all?
No, there haven't been. But, you know, John's there is like for 1 week, and I'm sure that he has like a lot of like people, like other options to give. And I'm just like happy that he's back, and I'm watching his show, and I'm very, very appreciative that he's back. He's just like a sort of a force of nature, and I'm very happy that he's on the desk again, even if it's one... for once a week.
You know, maybe the answer to this question is Jon Stewart as well, but I always ask comedians about the first time they met one of their comedy heroes. Do you have a story or memory about someone that you got to meet in the comedy world, whether Jon Stewart or otherwise, and sort of the experience of meeting them?
Well, Jon, as I said, it was kind of like a meeting that extended for an hour and a half. I met Pablo Francisco, who was the first ever person I've seen. So I'd never seen a live stand-up comedy show until 2001. I was in Miami. I was visiting there, and a friend of mine invited me. He's like, "We're gonna see stand-up comedy." I didn't know what to say. I wasn't like introduced to stand-up comedy really. And I saw Pablo Francisco for the first time. I was doing all of these voices. He was great. And then when I started doing stand-up comedy, and I found him like being on this on like with the same roster, and I went to him as like, "You're one of the first people that I saw," and I took a picture with him, and it was like such a warm moment.
Finally, is there a story or memory from your career that really makes you laugh now but was not funny when it happened?
Mm-hmm. You know, in order to preserve my mental health, I try to block all of the bad memories. So
are you able to laugh about you know, getting arrested and dealing with the Egyptian government now, or is it still too?
But that was funny from the get-go. That was funny from the get-go.
It was always funny.
It was always funny, which is very weird. I didn't fear any kind of, I wasn't scared as much. I was like saying, this is ridiculous being interrogated for that. But there's certain moments where, like, you know, there are people who put my theater under siege, and I had to go through a door and jump over a wall to be in a car and go back. And as much as it was scary, I always felt it was funny that I had to go through that.
Well, that's good that you're able to laugh at it even as it's happening, those things.
Yeah.
Well, Bassem, I really appreciate you talking with me today, and I think your career has been fascinating to watch, and I'm thrilled that you're about to go on this big tour. So
thank you so much
for being here.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you again to Bassem Youssef for being my guest on this week's show. As I said at the top, I may not agree with everything he had to say, but I think it was an important conversation to have on this show, and I hope you got something out of it. Bassem is performing two stand-up shows in Detroit this week before he heads to Europe for a big run of dates in April. You can get tickets to see him live at bassemyoussef.xyz. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.